Hi, my name is Pablo, and this is the Back Catalog Podcast with Pablo the Don. I know it's not exactly the last week of the month, but it's close. So thank you guys for allowing me the time, space, and grace to put this episode together, because it really does mean a lot to me. This month, I'm going to be covering the one and only Princess of Pop, Britney Spears. She single-handedly changed how pop stars were presented and promoted to a mainstream audience. She is one of the only examples of a pop star that I can really think of who hasn't had a racist or homophobic past. And most importantly, of anything I'm going to talk about today, she needs to be freed from this crazy-ass conservatorship she's been held up in for the last 13 years. Britney deserves to be celebrated at every turn, but considering how much progress has been made in overturning the conservatorship lately, there's nothing more that I want to do than go through all the music she made that was the soundtrack to so many of our lives. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and let me know on TikTok or Instagram or even Twitter if you enjoyed this deep dive and what your favorite Britney Spears moment of all time is. Britney Jean Spears was born December 2nd, 1982 in Macomb, Mississippi. She moved to Kentwood, Louisiana soon after and began taking dance lessons by the age of 3. She was also a gymnast and took vocal lessons at the same time. She quickly began competing in and winning in local kids' talent shows and even said she knew she was born to entertain at a very early age. Icon. She originally tried out for the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse at the age of 8, but they told her she was actually too young. So she instead hired an agent and was enrolled in a professional performing school in New York. So our sis is really qualified to do this, okay? She was also an understudy for the off-Broadway musical Ruthless, and she competed on Star Search before being cast in the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse in 1992. Honestly, I'm going to have to do an entire episode on how iconic and simultaneously problematic the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse was, but just to give you a taste of what the show had, Britney was inhabiting those halls in Orlando, Florida, at the same time as J.C. Chazé, Ryan Gosling, Christina Aguilera, and Justin Timberlake. Jessica Simpson even tried out at the exact same time, but unfortunately, she just didn't make the cut. After the show was canceled in 96, Britney returned to her normal life in Kentwood, where she said she was bored, but she won every single social award and was a starting point guard on her basketball team. Legend. In 97, Britney started having talks with Lou Pearlman, who was the scammer. I mean, he was the con artist. Or, I mean, he was the manager and sixth member. I mean, no, for real. He was just the founder of groups like Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. But he's going to get his own problematic episode, too. She was supposed to join his girl group called Innocence. But instead, her mother contacted Larry Rudolph, who honestly deserves to rot in hell. But we're going to get his ass together later. Larry, at the time, was an entertainment lawyer. And Lynn Spears, Britney's mother, who will also be dragged at some point, sent in some photos to and a videotape of Britney singing Whitney Houston's I Have Nothing. Instead of doing his fucking job and advising them, Larry decided to pitch Britney to labels himself. Look at what white men do. AKA doing things well beyond their reach. Not shocking at all. But this ended up working out for Britney. He had Britney record an unused Toni Braxton song for auditions, but when she went in, most of the record labels actually turned her down because they wanted pop groups. But Jive Records A&R Kevin Fessner said that Britney was special and he actually signed her, and we were well off to the races. It's worth noting at this time that Britney was assigned to work with Eric Forster White, who ended up changing her singing voice to be more distinct. He opted to have her sing in a lower tone and sound purposely anti-pop. Whatever that means. So all those rumors about Britney not actually using her real voice when she sings are true. And you can check her voice that she uses in her music versus the voice that she sang with on the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse tapes. Now, in my opinion, I understand why they did this. It was just to help Britney cut through and be unique. But at the same time, I hate that a lot of the scrutiny in her music career have been directly tied to her vocals, when it didn't have to be. I mean, yeah, it is a catch-22, because if she doesn't change her voice, we may never know who Britney Spears was. And so for that reason, I'm gonna shut my fucking mouth. So going into her first album, Britney said she wanted to make a Sheryl Crow sounding record, but way more contemporary and younger. Yeah, she didn't do that. Instead, in March of 98, she flew to Sweden to record music at Sharon Records with Dennis Pop and Max Martin, who's going to eventually get his very own deep dive episode because he deserves it. What came of that trip would be half of her first album, which would be called Baby One More Time. And let's put it this way. All of the album's most notable songs were created in Sweden. Sometimes I run. Sometimes I hide. Sometimes I'm scared of you. But all I really want is to hold you tight. Treat you right. Be with you day and night. Baby, all I need is time. But the album is truly an introduction to Britney. And while it's nowhere near my top or my favorite albums of hers, it's definitely a solid debut. The lead single, which shares the same name as the album, has one of the most memorable lead-ins with the iconic three-chord piano intro. If this didn't scream, pay attention to me, I frankly don't know what would. Not only that, but the lyrics, which borderline on sexually suggestive but also juvenile in nature, made this particular track stand out to both kids and adults. The song is literally about calling someone back, but the Swedes do this thing where they'll leave words out if they simply don't fit within the melody. So instead of hit me up, baby, one more time, it just became hit me, baby, one more time, which sent parents everywhere into a tizzy. And honestly, it's so fucking funny. The first three tracks on this album were also the first three of five singles and the biggest hits. And I usually don't love front loading, but here it just kind of works. The second single sometimes is about being apprehensive in love. And what I love most about Britney and this track specifically is that even though it's a ballad, it's still pretty mid-tempo. Britney knew her strengths and ballads were a rarity for her. Everything was upbeat and positive, even if the lyrics didn't always reflect a party. The third single, You Drive Me Crazy, is easily my favorite song from this album. Mainly because of the production. The song is in C minor, which is common, but the chord progression allows the track to build up so much tension until Britney sings. There's this like moment of just pure bliss. That tension that the production created literally confuses your brain to make you feel crazy. The rest of the album shows off Britney's range, diving in into Shaggy or some Sugar Ray Fly inspired beats on Soda Pop, as well as a cute, lovely little ballad called I Will Still Love You with her singing partner at the time, Dom Philip, who I must say is a phenomenal singer. The album, of course, debuted at number one on the Hot 200 and quickly became a cultural phenomenon, especially with the music videos. What I will say about this album is that listening back on it, it definitely doesn't age as well as some of her other albums. It is quite juvenile and meant for kids, and I think she realized that as she moved through her career and began to make more timeless music as she herself aged and gained more creative control in the studio. So between album one and two, well, actually, there was no real between. 6 days after completing the Baby One More Time tour, Britney was back in the studio in New York for her second album, Oops, I Did It Again. And oh my God, what a fucking fitting title. Aside from working with Max Martin and Eric White again, Britney also was able to score some contributions from the iconic songwriter Diane Warren, who is responsible for songs like Because You Love Me by Celine Dion, For You I Will by Monica, and Unbreak My Heart by Toni Braxton. She also enlisted the production and songwriting of Babyface, who wrote songs like Sitting Up in My Room by Brandy and Can We Talk by Tevin Campbell. On this album, Britney took a clear interest in R&B, especially on songs like Don't Go Knocking on My Door, which is probably the epitome of change in sound on this project. In a surprising but fun twist, Britney worked with Rodney Darkchild Jerkins on a cover of the 1965 Rolling Stones hit, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. The way they were able to make this sound so modern really gave the song some new legs. And honestly, I think this cover was the beginning of Britney taking covers and completely making them her own. Yes, She did do a cover of a Sonny and Cher song on her first album, but it sounded pretty similar to the original, in my opinion. This cover, however, was its own and honestly was a nod to her being connected to both rock and roll and modern R&B. The lead single, Oops, I Did It Again, was iconic once again, but the music video with that red leather jumpsuit put it over the top. I think every white person I know has attempted that outfit at a Halloween party at least once. The use of vocoders on the single Stronger made it sound eerily similar to the Backstreet Boys' Everybody, Backstreet's Back, but I think that was the signature sound of the Swedes at the time. I love this song so much, but I think the best single from this era is still Lucky. The song is about a fairy tale that has no real magic to it, and also how fame can be so unfulfilling. I personally just enjoy the narrative here. I still think this album is a bit immature and meant for middle of America 14-year-olds, but the next album I think is the album that is the true peek into what was coming for Britney and the sounds that would establish her as a true innovator in the pop space. Between Oops and her third album, Britney performed at the Super Bowl halftime show with Aerosmith and NSYNC. I believe this is also around the time that she and Justin Timberlake started dating. She would take some clear influence from what the popular culture was heading towards on this third album and start going in a more black, or what white executives call urban sound, on her third self-titled album. Britney is a collection of songs that reflect Britney's true mindset at the time, I think. The album's third single perfectly sums this up. She wasn't a girl, and she wasn't yet a woman either. I'm not a girl. This album is truly Britney asserting her dominance in terms of independence, and she combines the cheesy songwritings of Oops and Baby One More Time with sonically mature sounds, especially on songs like Lonely and Cinderella. Those songs are really basic and teeny bopper lyrically, but they could easily be played in a 21 plus club because of how they sound. She also definitely goes there with the sexually suggestive themes on songs like Boys and Anticipating. This was Britney's most futuristic sounding album to date, hallmarked by the iconic single Slave for You, which was produced by the Neptunes. Slave for You at the time was Britney's most unsuccessful single, but honestly at this point I think it's probably her third or fourth most memorable single. The 8-count drum in the beginning and her saying, I know I may be young, but I've got feelings too, and I need to do what I feel like doing. Was Britney taking all her critics to task for calling her earlier music a bad influence on children and how she should be a more wholesome role model? Truthfully, Slave for You might be the best pivot Britney made in her career. I think that by teaming up with the Neptunes and this third album being pretty successful, it allowed Britney to see that there was something there with more club-aimed pop music. She focused so much on the sound and the vibe of her music for the next three albums after this, and truly made some of the best music to dance to, even if the lyrics didn't necessarily make sense. Also, let's not forget the 2001 VMA performance with the snake draped around her neck. Looking back on it, this might be the most memorable performance of her career. And let's not forget that little lace black dress she wore on the red carpet that year. Truthfully though, all hands were on deck for this album, and she even had Justin Timberlake providing backing vocals on the song, What It's Like to Be Me, which is honestly something similar to a no strings attached kind of residual, but they gave it to her and she made it her own, to be honest with you. My favorite song on this album is the Eurodance inspired That's Where You Take Me. I think that's because it's softer production-wise compared to everything else on the album, but still maintains an upbeat feel and vibe. It's just so fucking cute and about being happy in a fulfilling relationship. But this album marked a turn for Britney. However, this next album would solidify her as an innovator and original. So a lot happened for Britney between 2001 and 2003. She was named the most powerful celebrity of 2002, had the second highest grossing tour of the year with the Dream Within a Dream tour, and starred in her first movie, Crossroads. Truthfully, I kind of like Crossroads, and I thought she was the best actor out of the main cast, which included Zoe Saldana and Taryn Manning. She also wore that infamous denim outfit that matched with Justin Timberlake to the 2002 VMAs. And then they broke up weeks later. She also vowed to take a break from her career, which lasted all of 6 months, where she then began recording her next album. Justin's first single, however, was a flop on the charts, so he went to a radio station and told them how he took Britney's virginity, then promptly dropped Cry Me a River and casted a Britney lookalike so people would believe she cheated on him. The funniest thing about this, though, is that the most well-known part of the song wasn't even Justin singing. It was one half of Flowetry and probably one of the greatest singer-songwriters of this generation, Marsha Ambrosius, singing. Justin is trash, but he will get his own episode of me talking trash about him one day. Britney also performed with Madonna, Christina Aguilera, and Missy Elliott at the 2003 VMAs, where she and Madonna went down in history for their kiss. And before you ask, no, it wasn't queer baiting. We know Madonna just wanted attention, and neither of these women are gay. The only thing about that performance is that I genuinely don't think the kisses were necessary. Madonna doing a tango with both of them was iconic, and it was a symbolic passing of the torch, but we know she never wanted to do that. So the whole thing was overshadowed by the dumb kisses. Also, I don't even remember that Missy was there, and that's how much she got erased from that performance. Anywho, throughout all of this, Britney recorded my favorite album and easily her most forward-thinking album up to that point, In the Zone. Things I want to note before talking about In the Zone is that, one, I appreciate how Britney kept her albums to like an hour runtime. That is a perfect time, and I think it gives listeners length, but also not too much. It's truly a lost art. Secondly, looking back on Britney and her career, I realized that she was so good at truthfully collaborating with Black artists, not culturally appropriating their sounds. While the sounds might have been Black R&B, the songwriting was undeniably a sound and feel that Britney had been doing well before taking a turn into R&B. And most importantly, the people she worked with were diverse. She never did anything distasteful or disrespectful and paid homage and expressed gratitude always. Anywho, In the Zone is my favorite Britney project, and it's hard to say that considering the album that came after this. It was an hour of straight bangers. There genuinely is only one skip, which we will discuss in a minute. Britney really put her sexuality out there with this album and took the most risks sonically that we'd seen thus far. She also straight up was talking shit on this album. She knew she was that girl by this time, and this album absolutely shows it. Now back to that skip. It's outrageous, and it has nothing to do with the song and everything to do with who wrote and produced it. Had this song been written by literally anyone else, it'd probably be in my top five of Britney songs. But no. This album features Britney getting getting more into the Middle Eastern sounds of like flutes and viols and drums. However, she does it tastefully and truly is a blueprint for how to incorporate other cultural elements into your music without being fucking offensive. So take notes, damn it. The first three songs really solidified this album for me. Me Against the Music with Madonna was probably one of the best Madonna songs I've ever listened to, and it felt like Britney's actual passing of the torch moment that the 2003 VMAs could have and should have been. Then the follow-up, and easily my favorite song on this album, is I Got That Boom Boom. This was the first time Britney had done a collab with any rappers, and at the time, the Crunk Movement and the Ying Yang Twins were at its peak. But again, Britney was just herself, as the Ying Yang Twins were nice compliments to what she was doing. I love the beginning gong and drums on this song, but also it's the soft tambourine in there that really just does it for me. This is an instant club classic, and I feel as though some people forget about it. Then after that, Britney gave us the mid-tempo song Showdown. Just give it when you are ready to play. Like this. Here comes the showdown. Which to me feels like something that could be played at a high fashion runway show today, and it would set the perfect tone. The digital beeps on the chorus are so beautifully placed, but also the wahs from the guitar are perfect. This felt like a Y2K moment captured in a song, and gosh, it's just amazing. Of course, there is arguably the best Britney song to exist on the album, Toxic. Which was just perfection in a song, to be honest. I keep using that word perfection, but there really isn't anything else to describe this album. The build-up to the chorus, the breakdown on the bridge, yeah, In the Zone was really an apt title for this project because that's what she was with the entire album, but specifically with Toxic. And the thing I love most about this album is that she worked with the right players. It has a trance dance vibe to it, and she went and worked with the trance dance electro king, Moby. She does another dance hall track in The Hookup where she does speak patois, but she does it tastefully, so I'm not even mad about it. This entire album just makes me want to dance, even though she did have some slower ballads like Shadow and the album closer Every Time. I just love how Britney got her point across with this album, that she was making dance music, and even with her slower songs, you could tell they were crafted in a way where DJs could easily remix them and turn them into dance songs. Her mind while crafting this album was just genius and truly was a high point, but by no means would this be her last great stop musically. After In the Zone, Britney got married twice, had a reality TV show with her second husband, Kevin Federline, and also had two kids with him. This is also when the press began their relentless pursuit of catching her every time she was in public. During this time, she drove with her baby in her lap, almost dropped her son because paparazzi didn't give her enough space to walk, caught her numerous times leaving clubs, and would even try to stick their cameras up her dress for crotch shots. It truthfully was so disgusting. But let's not forget one of the biggest pieces of shit who made Britney's life hell, Perez Hilton. Perez wished death on Britney, claimed she had a coke addiction, was a bad mother, and would bully her relentlessly through his popular blog site. At this point, Perez, TMZ, People, Us Weekly, and so many more of those shit magazines owe Britney financial compensation.
Hands up, cash out.
They put so much undue stress on her for money, and that's truly fucked up. Not only that, but she was also made to feel delusional, even though she was actually going through postpartum depression. Now, technically, the conservatorship doesn't happen until right after the next album's release, but this was just to set the scene for what happens almost immediately after. Regardless, in the midst of all this, Britney went back in the studio 3 years after In the Zone was released and put together arguably her most impactful album of her entire discography in Blackout. Of me. Blackout was easily my favorite Britney album until about a year ago when In The Zone crept up and took its spot. But Blackout is the album that changed the pop world so much that there is still a lasting effect and impact to this day. This album was the first time Britney had complete creative control, and honestly, what she put together was quite impressive. The album has much more electronic dance feel than any of her previous albums, and it also relies heavily on the use of autotune that was just coming into popularity with T-Pain in the last 2 to 3 years. Britney mostly worked with Danger for this project, who had previously worked with Carrie Hilson. Together, they, Danger and Carrie Hilson, wrote most of the album, including the iconic Gimme More. I don't know about y'all, but from the second I heard it's Britney, bitch, I knew she was in a different stratosphere. Britney made it a point to stay far away from anything personal on this album, which is why it's so fun and dancey. And even though we knew she was going through it in her personal life at the time, the album truly set the tone for what we would get for the last 2 years of the 2000s and a good portion of the 2010s. Britney reigned in the electropop era that brought us some of our faves like Lady Gaga and Katy Perry and Kesha. She paved this lane that truly helped people get through the horrible times of the recession, and everyone wanted to escape by partying and drinking. Radar is a song that does it all for me. I'm checking it so hard. The distorted synths on this thing sound like heartbeats, and I love that it has so much Eurodance inspiration. Heaven on Earth being a new wave vibe was so refreshing and new for her as well, and it felt like an updated disco track to me, like something Donna Summer would have easily done in the 2000s had she been around. Unfortunately though, at the time of its release, this album wasn't appreciated as much as it should have been. I genuinely think it's because of the 2007 VMA performance, which, looking back, after I watched it, it's really not even that bad, to be honest. If anything, I think Britney lacked her usual confidence when moving around the stage, and that affected her stage presence. Now, I'm not saying she wasn't high or drunk. I'm just saying, looking back, it was definitely better than what was said at the time. Also, I know a lot of people were up in arms about her lip-singing, but truthfully, when has Britney not lip-synced? We aren't going to see her for her vocal performances. We're going to see her for the full package. Britney Spears is an entertainer. Anyways, Blackout is easily her second best album, and I hate that the controversy surrounding her life blinded people from that. It's one of the biggest reasons why I don't consider people's personal lives in their music when reviewing it. And no, I'm not talking about no damn abusers. I'm talking about people who are having public relationship issues or are always in the tabloids for asinine reasons. I think Blackout, having been released 14 years ago, has helped its legacy. I just hope people understand just what this album did, though. After Blackout was released, Britney, unfortunately, was put into the conservatorship, and it seemed like they immediately put her back to work. We know now that she had very little control and essentially just did what people told her to in terms of her actual day-to-day life. But when it came to her music and the production, she actually had more control, and what resulted was arguably her strongest album while in the conservatorship in Circus. Circus was released in late 2008, and honestly, it sounded a lot more pop and more reminiscent of her first two albums with an injection of Blackout in there. Actually, there's even a song that appears on both Blackout and Circus, Radar, which again is my favorite on this album too. The singles here were great though. I thoroughly enjoyed Womanizer. When it came out, especially the video where she says, "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, you're cool, fuck you," to the press as she's giving a conference. One of my favorite things from this album, like most people, is the song If You Seek Amy. Which, if you say phonetically very quickly, spells out fuck. I think that type of wordplay was so clever, especially with how the melody goes. Again, this is just an album that, for the most part, makes you want to dance, and you couldn't go anywhere without hearing this. It was even safe for, like, high school dances at the time. I think the song Circus honestly chronicles her dealings with the paparazzi so well. I think at the time, everyone did turn towards her personal life for entertainment instead of the music. But this album definitely had a lot more slower songs than I think any other Britney album to date at this point. And I actually enjoyed that because I think Britney showed here that the voice that we had been accustomed to wasn't actually her natural singing voice. And it really was just there to give her some uniqueness. I loved her most on the song Blur, which reminded me of What Goes Around Comes Around, unfortunately, by Justin Timberlake, with the drums. And I think Lace and Leather is a very underrated song on this album, especially that plucking bass line. I think this era for me is just a little sticky because I genuinely believed at the time that I was listening to this back in 2008, 2009, that Britney was on the right track to getting her life back together and getting her life back. But she wasn't. And she was actually just being abused all the time. I think in all, Circus is fine, but it didn't push the envelope like we were accustomed to her doing. Regardless, I think this is truly the second to last good album in the Britney discography. Now, before I continue, I want y'all to know that this next album is probably going to be the last album where it's an overwhelmingly positive review that I have. It's clear that after this album, Britney's musical career starts to go downhill. Now, I don't know if that's because she was fed up with the conservatorship and just didn't try, or if she was losing touch with who she was as an artist. Either way, I'm not holding it against her. I'm just giving you fair warning so you aren't caught off guard by my opinions. So from 2009 to 2011, Britney released her own clothing line, went on the Circus tour, which is one of the highest grossing tours of all time, and started dating her agent, Jason Trawick. She also appeared in a Glee episode that was themed around her career, which was cool, and probably the only time I watched Glee while it was actually on air. Don't hate me, I went back and watched it once it was over, and it was okay. Britney said she wanted to make her seventh studio album completely different from Circus, and boy, did she do that. Where Circus was like an eighth grade dance party, her next album took full advantage of the EDM craze and also the popularity of party culture with shows like Jersey Shore being the biggest thing on television at the time. The result of this was Femme Fatale, which I think is her most underrated album that she's ever put out. You know I can make your night, you wanna get it. You got something that I like, but I might regret it. Me and you were a disaster. For Femme Fatale, she collaborated with some of her usual suspects, like with Max Martin and Deja, to create the EDM-influenced party club anthem. Till the World Ends, to this day, gets played in those super white clubs where white girls shake their head from side to side and do that damn Scarlett Johansson dance. Britney ate the girls up with that one, though, it's no shade, I swear. On the song I Wanna Go, Britney does some amazing callbacks to Hit Me Baby One More Time and Crazy, and I love when artists tie their work together with little lines that fans can pick up on. Femme Fatale was high voltage and high energy and could easily be played constantly throughout a jam. Hold It Against Me was giving dubstep, and it was a surprising element that Britney introduced into her discography that I loved for her. She really could have carved out her own space as being one of those EDM girls of the 2010s, and I'm kind of sad she didn't take more advantage and do features with like David Guetta or Avicii at the time. When the album was released, a ton of critics railed Britney for not really being involved in the writing or production, and I ask again, what the fuck do we listen to Britney Spears for? Like, at this point, she was proven. We knew she could write, and we knew if she wanted to, she could sing. This album was for performance, though, and for dancing to. She did everything we truthfully needed on this album, and even on the slower EDM tracks like Inside Out, Britney gave a convincing vocal and made something cute for the girls to get ready to for the club. I Wanna Go is definitely my favorite song in this project, mainly for the build-up and the voice effects. It makes me feel like it's the late 90s and some gym and Funk Soul Brothers or something from Daft Punk's Discovery is coming on. This album was purely fun, and you can't help but dance to it. I also really enjoy the stop-start nature of Up and Down and the vocals on the chorus. Britney also, again, was talking her shit on that track, basically calling the jealous girls basic and that getting her mans was easy. Like, all right, girl. In all, Femme Fatale was really that girl for a good time, and I can't lie, I kind of need to add it to more of my DJ sets. Britney again went on tour for Femme Fatale, then immediately started working on her next album. She also joined the judges panel for X Factor, the season that would actually feature Fifth Harmony, Bea Miller, and Erin Rae, who all went on to have successful careers. Fuck Mila Kabeja, though. Right before the release, Britney also announced that she'd be going to Vegas for her own residency. She titled the album Britney Jean, and it dropped in November of 2013, and truly, I hate it. I think it might be because will.i.am executive produced it, and at the time, he was wearing those custom-built helmets over his Gumby haircut. But maybe I don't like it because it was just so sad, and I just didn't enjoy it. Like, this was not music to cry in the club to. This was just bad music. The production felt like she was reaching back to the Britney-titled album days, and we were just so far past that at this point. Like I said, I don't know if her and Will just didn't click well or if the album was too ambitious, but it just didn't hit. I really don't like a single song on this album, and I'm not trying to be rude, but nothing is even worth noting aside from Scream and Shout, and even that is probably more so because it was so overplayed, so much so that you couldn't help but sing it. Work Bitch was okay, but it gave trying to recreate the magic of Give Me More and Piece of Me rather than build on what those songs already established. Truthfully, like I said, I'm not trying to be rude, but Britney Jean just completely missed the mark for me. And it really made me question, like, what Britney was actually doing with her life and career at that point, and if everything was actually okay. Because I just wasn't used to her not giving a album where more than half the songs were good. After Britney Jean, Britney appeared on other people's songs like Miley Cyrus's SMS off her Bangers album and Iggy Azalea's Pretty Girls in 2015. Both songs were pretty lackluster, but it was cool to see Britney branch out. But nothing was really hitting like it used to. She also appeared on Jane the Virgin, which was fucking cool, and I fucking love that show. But other than that, she didn't do much of note other than date a couple of guys and renew her RCA contract because she was still bogged down by the conservatorship. She was still in Vegas at this time, and she was killing it there. She really was. In August of 2016, Glory release, which was definitely better than Britney Jean, in my opinion. It's a wide spread of genres, but at this point, I think they were dabbling in everything to see what would stick if they threw it at a wall. What I did enjoy about this album is her expanded collaborations. Enlisting DJ Mustard was cool, but my favorite song here is easily Summer Party with Tinashe. It's a dancehall R&B cut that I think they fit well together on. I also like the dance R&B pop EDM blend vibe of Hard to Forget Ya. And I think Glory just isn't my favorite because Britney has done so much better. And while I appreciate it for what it is, my biggest issue is that Britney, for once, was letting the sound dictate her artistry. She had dabbled in so many genres and sound at this point, and she always made it her own, but on Glory, it sounded like she was doing something that wasn't authentic to herself. And she wasn't even adding that Britney flair that we became accustomed to. Also, some of the mixing on this thing, like on Private Show, legitimately hurts my ears. Like, why are the vocals so pushed forward and not in a isolated kind of way, but in a let's overpower everything else by making her sound so loud that the music in the background sounds distracting to anyone listening? Glory wasn't horrible, but it wasn't what I wanted or needed from a woman approaching her mid-30s and who had had a long tenured career in the game. This is Britney's last album to date, except she did release another deluxe edition of Glory in 2020, and I didn't even really bother to listen because I just don't think there's anything worth revisiting on that album. And I can't even say, I don't know. I don't know if I hope Britney makes another album. I think at this point, what I hope is that Britney is free and Britney does what Britney wants to do. I would be sad if Glory is the last thing we hear from Britney Spears, but I wouldn't be upset because I know what she's gone through. So, Britney Spears is an icon, plain and simple. She reinvented what it meant to be a pop star. She's part of the reason why I love music so much. She was the soundtrack to so many of our childhoods, and honestly, the most unproblematic fave that anyone could have. She came in, gave us hits, gave us choreo, gave us entertainment, and served us looks. She minded her good goddamn white business and did what she did best. I hate that ultimately this woman's career was out of her control in her entire 30s, and that conservatorship took away arguably what could have been some of the best years of her career. Britney Spears revolutionized pop music and its landscape, even when she might have been at her lowest point in her personal life, and I'm gonna need people to recognize the skill and talent there. She may not be everyone's favorite pop star, but she is mine, and I love what she's done for music. I know I didn't touch on the conservatorship too much, but that's because I want this to focus on the artist and the music and the feeling she gave us all. We know the conservatorship is bullshit and abusive, and we know that Free Britney is more than a hashtag, and we know that we can't stop fighting for her right to be free. And we know that we can't stop fighting for her right to be free. I chose Britney for July's deep dive because she just got the ability to hire her own lawyer, and her longtime manager and co-conservator Larry Rudolph, formally resigned from both positions. Things are starting to look up for Britney, and I felt like this was the best way to celebrate her, by remembering all that she's done and how she's made us feel. I doubt she's listening to this, but if she is, simply thank you, Britney. I don't think I'd be doing any sort of music criticism if it weren't for you and my parents making your Dream Within a Dream tour my first concert at 7 years old. So thank y'all so much for listening to this deep dive. This is definitely the longest episode I've done to date, but it is so worth it. Thank y'all so much for being patient. I just wanted to get this episode right. So with that being said, make sure you follow the podcast Instagram at Back Catalog Pod, catalog spelled the American way, C-A-T-A-L-O-G. Follow me on Instagram at Pablo.TheDon. Follow me on TikTok at PabloTheDon, all one word. And follow me on Twitter at PabloTheDon. Thank you guys so much for listening to another episode. This has been the Back Catalog Podcast with Pablo the Don. Like this. Take you to spending my life.